From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, as flooding affects parts of Wisconsin, we look back at how one southwest Wisconsin town debated its flood-prone future.
Many people feeling like we should just clean up the mess, rebuild where we are, and many others just have left because the risks are too great.
Later, if the sun is a mass of incandescent gas, why does it hold together the way it does?
The head of the Milwaukee Sailing Center explains how a sport can also be an art form.
It's learning how to figure out where the wind is coming from and how do you adjust your sail this way or that way. And there are mechanics that are involved in all of that process that make sailing a relatively easy sport to do physically.
And with thousands of Harleys in town, we explore how the Harley-Davidson Museum tells the story of the iconic bike's distinctive engines. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's a second consecutive day of dry weather around Wisconsin, but that does not mean the danger from flooding has gone away in waterlogged parts of the state. Heavy rains have inundated the whole state, but especially central and southwestern Wisconsin.
Wednesday, Governor Walker added six more counties to the state of emergency list for Wisconsin, including La Crosse and Vernon counties in the western part of the state.
Just to the south, you'll find the village of Gay's Mills, known for its apple orchards and its stunning location on the Kickapoo River. People there, and of course up and downstream, are bracing themselves for flooding as well.
But the situation is nothing new for people in Gay's Mills. It was damaged by raging water in 2007 and again in 2008. And in 2009, WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz visited the town. At the time, residents were considering whether it should just pack up and move out of the flood. Plain. Here is that report.
Gay's Mills, population 625. That's what the sign reads as you drive into the village tucked along the Kickapoo River. Apple trees dot the ridges above. The six-block-long main street appears to be perking. The village greenhouse, a grocery store, and Red Apple Inn restaurant. As fond as she is of the community, village librarian Maura Otis says it's time for Gay's Mills to stop duking it out with the Kickapoo River.
Many people feeling like we should just clean up the mess, rebuild where we are, and many others just have left because the risks are too great. However, I think for those of us that are working towards this goal, it is to provide a safe haven for people who choose to stay.
Otis serves on the village's long-range planning committee. It's hoping at least a dozen families will move into the new site, and with time, more will follow. But some don't plan to budge. Blanche Gable has ridden out both floods, 2007 and 2008. The 74-year-old says she didn't have to face them alone. People just showed up at her door to help.
They came in and then they scraped that black rubber off my floor. And here is the vet, you know, the veterinarian who was here helping. He lost a bunch of cattle in the flood. And yet he came over to help me.
Instead of moving, Gable is going to have her house elevated. When the job is done, she'll be 40 inches higher off the ground. Some residents have no intention of even making modifications. Darlene Williams says she and her husband devised their own flood action plan years ago.
Well, when we see the water coming up, we go to the basement. We have a furnace in the basement, and we take the blower out of the furnace and seal it all up, and then we wait and see how much water we're going to get.
If the water rises to a foot at their back door, Williams opens the door and lets the basement fill up with water.
We've lived here 29 years, and we've only had water in the house twice.
Emily Schendel says she realizes Gay's Mills might be underwater again.
I don't know, I like the idea of how old and how small and how quaint, and you know everybody.
She says it's just too depressing to watch homes in town be demolished. The 20-year-old remembers the day the houses on either side of hers were torn down after FEMA had bought out the flooded homes of people who decided they'd had enough.
They start really early in the morning, and you just feel this rumbling, and that's what woke me up, is like my house was shaking, and I look out my window, and then it's just crushing it down, and just all of a sudden, and there's just a big pile of rubble.
About half the homes in the floodplain have been or are slated to be either demolished or elevated to prevent another round of destruction. Even if some townspeople refuse to move, Gays Mills does intend to relocate its government center to higher ground. The new building will house Village Hall, the library, and Chamber of Commerce. Librarian Maura Otis says the move presents the town with a perfect opportunity to become more energy efficient.
Our hope in the new development is to construct it at renewable ready standards. Now, that would mean that there's some reinforcement in the roof for solar panels. We also hope to provide some district heat, and we're looking at geothermal or biomass.
Gays Mills has the unique chance to become a model rural community, according to Rich Stevenson. He owns a factory in town, one of its biggest employers.
We have the relocation of the residential, relocation of the municipal, but then there's also the creation of district heating plant that ties into the economic development work we're doing here to recruit businesses to Gays Mills. And we do have two businesses that are interested in coming here.
That could add jobs to the community. Right now, it relies on Stevenson's operation, along with farming and the apple orchards. Gays Mills' major annual event, its Apple Festival, is just weeks away. Part of the festivities take place at Darlene Williams Church Hall.
We will have pancake breakfast in here, and we will serve many hundred people. And this place will just be crammed full. We do Saturday and Sunday.
That's the plan, at least for this year. Williams Church, the oldest in town, is located in the heart of the floodplain.
Isn't that beautiful?
Susan Bentz, 89.7, WUWM.
And Susan Bentz is with us in the studio now. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Mitch.
So let's update the story. That was 2009, and the goal at that point was to get everybody out of the way of danger in the case of flooding. It's been an incredibly wet couple of weeks. What's the situation in Gays Mills today?
Well, I should say briefly that they did move their village offices, the library, there's a grocery store. All of these things have moved uphill in that safe zone, but there are still homes and businesses that are have been alive and pretty well in that original floodplain. So now there's anticipated flooding as we speak.
So as we're having this conversation, there has been heavy rain kind of upstream.
Exactly.
And so people in Gays Mills are keeping a watchful eye?
Very watchful. So the problem is, of course, that that rain has been upstream in La Crosse and Vernon County. Gays Mills is downstream. And in addition to that heavy rain and the river that's going to be rushing, there were two dams upstream that also failed. So there's high concern. The emergency people in the county are saying as it may be flooding late tonight or tomorrow, but they're watching it closely. They're sandbagging. Everybody's watching and I'm sure worrying.
And the homes and businesses that are still in the floodplain, this isn't necessarily because they didn't want to leave. It's just because it's such a large operation, or a little of both?
Well, at the time when I was reporting on it, that was the crux of it. There are people who just want to stay there, for whom that, you know, that portion, that means Gays Mills to them, and that's where they want to be. For others, there may have been factors that I don't know about. But consequently, there are still people who are living there.
And we should note that you spent some time trying to reach and speak with people in Gays Mills, but
Absolutely.
They are understandably pretty busy.
Very,
there.
Very busy. So we haven't been able. I spoke with a public health official who said, we really can't talk now. We're watching. We're ready to, you know, assist if necessary. But no one has time or is willing to talk right now.
Susan Bentz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
That's WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. You can learn more about flooding in Gays Mills both historically and today at WUWM.com.
Keep listening. After a break, we'll talk with astronomy contributor Gene Creighton about how the sun keeps its cool or keeps its act together. This is Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. Yo-ho, it's
hot. The sun is not.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. So the rain has stopped for now, anyway. And with the sun shining on southeastern Wisconsin, we're going to talk about our nearest star with our very own star, astronomy contributor Jean Creighton.
She joins us every month to talk about the universe and our humble place in it. Hello, Jean Creighton. How are you?
I'm great. Hi, Bonnie.
So one of the things that we like to do on public radio, because we have this educational component, is we like to answer listener questions. And we do that with our Bubbler Talk series every week. Somebody asks about something. You recently had somebody ask you a question that is going to generate our segment this month. And so what was it?
The question was, what keeps the sun together? What holds the sun together? And my first response, my sort of internal thought was, interesting question, but what is the person really asking me? And I pause and I realize that any person who's looked at gas, they know that if they have it in a container and they take the lid off the container, then the gas just dissipates. So that helped me realize, oh, of course, you would wonder if the sun is made of gas, why, and I don't have a lid on it, why doesn't it just go away? Why doesn't it just dissipate into thin air, as it were?
So my first answer to that, I don't know that I'm anywhere near right, would be gravity.
Yes.
I was right.
So gravity is what makes stars tick. But that's not the only thing that's happening in a star, like the sun or any star for that matter. You have gravity that wants to pull the star in, so to make it contract. But on the other hand, you have a very hot gas. Technically, it's called a plasma, an ionized hot gas. Ionized just means that some of those electrons have parted ways and they're free roaming around. So these fast-moving particles are moving fast enough that they're actually creating resistance to gravity. You can't squeeze these particles further, closer to each other. They resist. They don't want to be further kind of confined. So the hotter the gas, the more these particles are bouncing around, creating more resistance. Does that make sense?
Yes. So that keeps gravity from basically turning the sun into a black hole.
That's right.
Okay.
So basically, this is what holds up the sun. And that energy that holds up the sun comes from nuclear reactions within. And of course, a nuclear reaction separates a star from a wannabe. That's the nuclear reaction makes light for the star and also helps resist against gravity. That's where the energy comes from. So a star like the sun is going to be held together by gravity. And it's true that some of that gas will dissipate a little bit, but it's like you can almost imagine it like a person sheds some cells of skin, but you wouldn't say that we lose mass in any measurable way. That way.
It's not noticeable.
It is certainly not noticeable.
Right.
So that would be the situation with the sun. That yes, of course, some particles are going to escape the sun. And if we have one of these fantastic storms, even blobs of material noticeable might escape. But overall, the sun is so massive that those small flashes of activity aren't going to result in a change to the mass of the sun.
So you're talking about solar flares?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the ones when we see the very dramatic ones in NASA pictures that they're shooting out many,
that's right.
Many.
That's right. So that's kind of the overall discussion about the sun. Then, of course, I remembered other questions that people ask that are similar to that, and that is, well, what about a place like Saturn? What keeps it from dissipating again? Because here we don't have nuclear energy, really. We don't, it's not a star. But here we have a smaller amount of gravity, smaller internal pressure. The internal pressure here now is primarily just because we have some fluid that's moving at some speed. And in the end, again, we've achieved equilibrium. I know that sometimes people get a little, they have a hard time imagining a planet that doesn't have a surface that's made of gas that is still stable. And yet, if these places are cold enough and big enough, gravity makes them control their size. And because they're cold, they're not moving fast enough for that internal pressure to overwhelm gravity.
Now, does movement within their orbit have anything to do with this, too? I mean, how fast they're spinning on their axis or how fast they're going around their star, does that have any effect on their shape?
Yes. The material point here is that if the planet were to move too fast, were to spin too fast, it might become unstable. It could be that some of this gas is moving now so fast that it actually can't be held by gravity anymore. But all these planets are spinning at rates that are much too comfortable for that to be an issue.
And the sun itself, is the sun orbiting anything?
Yes. The sun is orbiting around the center of our galaxy. So in 100 million years or so, it'll complete a full orbit around the center of our galaxy. And of course, in the center of our galaxy, we have a supermassive black hole. And what many people don't realize is that the sun spins as well as revolves around the center. And because the sun is a fluid, its rate of spinning is different at the pole than it is at the equator. So it's faster at the poles. It has a longer, it has a bit of a pudge, the sun, a little at the center. So you get all this very wound up. The magnetic field of the sun gets all wound up because of this, what we call differential rotation. The rate of rotation is different depending on where you are on the sun. So it's all very exciting to imagine all this dynamic systems in our solar system and beyond.
Does the sun have a core that's solid, or is it all gas?
Yeah. The answer to your question is there's no core, there's no hard core, but this is a large star, dense. It might behave more, especially as you get to the core, because the pressures are very high, it might behave more like a solid than a gas in your experience.
Okay.
Right?
That was my question, is does it act more like a solid?
Yeah.
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 Even though it isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not going to be moving very fast, or certainly it won't feel like, oh, if I just open this lid, things are going to start happening. It will stay pretty put. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is there anything else that people have asked you about the sun that you want to make sure people know before we wrap up today?
One of the most common misconceptions is that the solar system has millions of stars. I hear this all the time. And I think it's because the solar system and the Milky Way in some people's minds has been intertwined. And of course, many of our listeners know this, so I apologize for those of you who do. But just to make sure, the solar system is one star, the sun, 8 planets, and some change. All the other stars that we see are much, much farther away, and they are part of the Milky Way.
Right. They are not part of our solar system.
That is right. So right. There's only
one
star.
We are part of
them. We belong to the Milky Way, to be sure. But all those stars out there that we see, those beautiful stars in summertime, they are not in the solar system.
Okay. Just enjoy them.
Yes, yes.
It's like real estate we don't have to take care of.
Happily.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
All right, Jean. Well, I hope you have a wonderful end of August, and we will talk with you next month.
Thank you so much.
The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma. The sun's not simply made out of gas. No, no, no. The sun is...
Jean Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and a regular Lake Effect contributor. You can hear our past conversations with her at WUWM.com.
We'll shift from solar to wind power when Lake Effect continues and talk sailing on Lake Michigan. That's coming up next on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee has no shortage of ways to enjoy the water. Kayaking along its rivers, swimming in Lake Michigan, fishing off a breakwall, or taking a boat tour of the harbor.
There is still another option we didn't mention, though, and that is one that's been around for almost probably the longest. Sailing. Drive over the Hone Bridge on a pleasant summer day, and you're bound to see a picturesque scene of Milwaukee's lakeshore, complete with puffy white sails dotting the harbor.
For many, though, the idea of actually being on a sailboat may seem too expensive or time-consuming. But the leaders of the Milwaukee Community Sailing Center say their mission has been making sailing accessible to everyone. And after 40 years, the center believes it's taught over 15,000 adults how to sail.
One of those 15,000 is Holly Church, the center's current director. She recently joined WUWM's Rachel Owens to talk about what the Sailing Center offers, its history, and whether sailing really is for everyone.
Basically, what the Sailing Center is a private nonprofit organization. We teach people how to sail, and then we give them free use of our boats to sail on throughout the summer months. And the way that that works is that people join as members. Memberships run about $375, $385 for an individual for a year. That runs from the day that they start sailing with us until that same day the following year. It runs up to about $650, $675 for a couple's membership, which is, you know, just a committed relationship in a single household. We don't define that necessarily by husband and wife. It could be a father and a daughter, a mother and a son. It could be anybody who wanted to participate in that couple's membership. And the way that that works is that once they are members, they are able to enroll, if they need to, in some of our basic courses, which are instructional courses designed to teach them how to sail. We teach those lessons in about 2 weeks' time frame. Basically, what happens then is once they come through our program, either with previous experience or through our lessons, we are able to rate them. We have a three-tiered rating system, light, medium, heavy air. And we usually rate our beginning students with light air ratings, which means that they can come down in any wind conditions of 10 knots or less, go down to our dock house, check out a boat, and go sailing free of charge. So it's a phenomenal program. It's one of the few in the country that still operates this way. We have that free access to boats and the membership, which is an annual renewing membership. And it's just a great way to get out and experience the lake.
What do my first lessons look like? Do I get out on the water right away?
Absolutely. The way our program is set up is that we have a two-week program. It runs mornings, afternoons, or evenings based upon your availability and your time frame. It's about 3 hours every day. We bring you down Monday through Thursday every day for 2 weeks. The first night of your class is going to be an instructional theory type of course. We don't go out sailing, but we actually get you down on the boats. We teach you the boat parts. We teach you some of the concepts of sailing. Nights 2, 3, and 4 of our basic instruction are out on the water, completely on the water with our volunteer instructors. We have a great core of volunteer instructors who've actually come through our programs, learned how to sail, come back and teach the students that we have coming into our programs. The second week of class, we pull our volunteer instructors off the boats. Believe it or not, our students are ready by day 5 to be out on their own. So they are out on the water with other students in the boats, and they are under the supervision of a staff member who's teaching the course. By the end of that 2 weeks, probably 90% of our students are ready for their light air rating. Sometimes they need a little bit more time, but not very often. And when they do need a little more time, we just plug them into a variety of different ways that they get that experience. But once they have that rating, they can then go out and go sailing on light air days. We have intermediate and advanced level programs for people who want to go on and get different skills, try different boats, try racing or cruising. Just a great, you know, set of programs that we offer.
I would imagine that the safety is a concern for a lot of people. It can look a little daunting out there to someone who's new to it. They may have been in a power boat or something bigger, but to be exposed on Lake Michigan like that could be a little scary. So how do you address that?
Yep, it could be. Well, wonderful thing. We call the areas that we allow our sailors to go into A, B, C, and D. A and B are actually inside our breakwall. We have a wonderful, here in Milwaukee, we actually have one of the best sailing areas in the entire Midwest, as far as I'm concerned. We have a wonderful break wall outside our city that protects our city's water line. And it is about 3.5 miles long and about a half of a mile wide. You could go out there and sail all day and be in protected water. So it's just a wonderful situation that we have here in Milwaukee. Our beginning sailors are very close to our facility. We keep them in the area that is the closest to the sailing center. We can actually look out our window and see how things are going. We have a dock master on duty at all times, and that dock master is basically our liaison between the water and the land. He's the person or she's the person who's actually monitoring the weather, knows exactly who's out at any given time, what area they're in, what their rating is. That's the person who's monitoring wind conditions, wave conditions. They're the ones who are making the decisions about where everybody can sail for that day. We have an incredible safety record. We keep it that way. We have, of course, certain rules and regulations that people have to follow. We do have conditions where we don't let our boats out. We call them black flag days. And if the winds and the conditions get to be too much, waves too high, winds are growing, storms are moving through the area, that kind of thing, we do black flag days, which means that there are no boats that are leaving our docks. Mm. So we're very careful.
You've been involved since the beginning, it sounds like.
I learned how to sail at the sailing center when I was just a kid, a teenager, actually, 18 years old. And I've been there ever since in some capacity or another, either a member of sailing, learning how to sail, enjoying the equipment. I went back to teach probably 30 years ago, started helping them teach and work there. And then I went off and did my own exploration of the world and had some fun, lived in the Caribbean for a while, came back and took on the program director position, and I've been there since 20 years.
The Midwest lured you back from the Caribbean. That's pretty impressive.
Milwaukee is actually one of the most beautiful places in the summer. People who don't know Milwaukee who come here are floored by our city, our people, our lakefront, the water activity. We just have a beautiful city here. We're really lucky to have it here.
I absolutely agree. Speaking of access to the water, you also have developed a new program. It's a new partnership called STEMward, Sailing into Schools. So how does that work? Mm-hmm.
We have a STEM program, and we started it about 5 years ago. We have a board member on our board who is very involved in education, building programs. She's just been wonderful, Carolyn Joyce. And Carolyn helped us launch our STEM program. We now go into middle schools at the moment. We're in about 3 or 4 different middle schools. And we go in during the fall and the spring months and actually teach a 2-week STEM program with them. They have then a continuation of the STEM program within their curriculum. At some point in time during that STEM program, those kids actually come down and go sailing with us on the water, get to experience what that's all about that they've learned about for the past month. It's just wonderful. Brings kids right from the middle schools into the lakefront.
There are a lot of physics involved in sailing, yeah. And it seems like a great way to tie some on-hands training in with your science in mm-hmm. the classroom teaching.
Yep, they actually go right into building boats. These kids in the STEM program are building model boats. They're testing buoyancy and friction, and they're learning about angles. And it's a great program. It's a lot of fun to teach. It's a lot of fun to watch the kids come through it. They have a big sailboat race at the end with the boats that they've built, and it's just a lot of fun to watch them go through that.
Is sailing really for everybody?
It is absolutely for everybody. We have kids ages 8 to 11 who do our Prams in the Park program, and that's a fun, inventive, creative program for kids. Our youth program is 12 to 17. We get them out on the water right away. We have adults from ages 18 to 85. The process of sailing doesn't involve physical strength. You can be a woman who is like one of our most active sailors, who's in her late 70s, early 80s, and she comes down every day, and she's not pulling or lifting or doing anything like that that's really stressful. Sailing is more of an art form. It's learning how to figure out where the wind is coming from and how do you adjust your sail this way or that way. And there are mechanics that are involved in all of that process that make sailing a relatively easy sport to do physically. In fact, we do have on Fridays, we have rides for persons with disabilities. They come down every Friday throughout the summer. We basically shut down our programs for lessons on Fridays, and we open up to persons with special needs. And we bring those people down. They actually get to get out in a boat with some of our great volunteers, and they go sailing. They get to try the sailing. They get to sit at the boat and just relax and watch the water if they want to.
They can actually steer and move sails if they'd like to. It's a great way to bring people with special needs down and get them exposed to water, too.
And then also, it seems like for people who want to take it to the next level, you also have racing available.
We do. We have racing programs. We have cruising programs. We have about 5 different types of boats for adults. Some of them are very high-tech racing-type sailboats. The workhorse of our fleet is a very simply rigged, very stable, very forgiving platform. It's called an Ensign, and it's a wonderful boat. But we do go right up the gamut for the race-type boats. We have a couple of one-design race boats. We have Solings, which are the Olympic class, or actually the former Olympic class race boat. So people who want to take that racing edge get that experience that way. We also have a couple of cruising boats for people who want to learn how to take a week off and go into the Caribbean and rent a boat and go sailing.
What are some of the upcoming events or great ways to get into sailing with the Milwaukee Community Sailing Center?
Well, we're pretty much wrapped up for our sail venture this year. But for somebody who's not really sure if this is for them, next spring, they should take a look at our schedule and see what we have. We have a program called Sail Venture. It's a 2-day program. It's designed for people who just want to come down and feel it out, see if it's something that they would enjoy doing before they put the money down for membership and lessons. So they can come down. We do a full 2-night program. They get out on the water, hopefully both nights if the weather permits. That's a great way for somebody to try it. If somebody is looking for just general information and stuff about classes, they can find that all online. We do have a couple of annual events that we have coming up, which are open to the public, too. We have a great lobster boil coming up, and it is about $60 for somebody to come down, get a lobster dinner, support a great cause. It's a lot of fun. Outdoor tents, we boil the lobsters right there on site. It's a lot of fun.
Looks like you also do classes throughout the wintertime.
We do. We have classes all winter long. They're basically dry land theory type courses, but we'll do everything from Milwaukee history. We'll bring in people to talk about the history of Milwaukee. We do water condition seminars. We have classes that run from introduction to sailing right up through the specific rules of racing. So there's a whole variety of things that we do, knot tying, GPS. If people want to learn more about cruising and what that's all about, just a great number of classes throughout the winter months to keep people involved and engaged.
And all those are taking place at your beautiful facility.
We have a great facility. The Sailing Center is on the easternmost point of Milwaukee, the landfill. If anyone is familiar with where the bikes and the kites and the skate rentals are, they're at Veterans Park. We are the only 2-story white building out there, and it is a beautiful facility. We just had it built about 9 years ago. We operated for about 30 years out of a one-room shack, and we now have one of the most beautiful facilities in the state, as far as I'm concerned.
Any terms that you think would be handy to start us off with? Something good that someone could be armed with to go into their first lesson, perhaps.
They are going to get into an awesome boat with a super hull. They're going to learn how to avoid the boom. And they're going to learn about their sails, the mainsail, the jib. They're going to learn about the lines that they pull. All of our ropes are called lines. They're going to learn how to haul lines, pull lines. They're going to learn how to leave the dock, sail through the mooring basin. They're going to learn about points of sail, tacking, jibing. It's just a lot of fun. And they should come down and start. And the scenery is well worth the time and the energy and the fun of the learning process. Once they get out there on their own, oh, they won't come back unless we make them.
Well, Holly Church, I'd really like to thank you for coming in today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Holly Church is the director of the Milwaukee Community Sailing Center. She spoke with WUWM's Rachel Owens. You can find more information about the Sailing Center, including its annual lobster boil event on Friday in Veterans Park, at WUWM.com.
Well, sailboats tend to be quiet. The steady thrum of motorcycle engines is reverberating around the Milwaukee area already ahead of this weekend's Harley-Davidson anniversary. But what makes them sound the way they do? We'll make a visit to the engine room at the Harley-Davidson Museum when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR Now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The 115th anniversary celebration for Harley-Davidson gets fully underway tomorrow, but thousands of bikers are already in town. Many of them will visit the Harley-Davidson Museum while they're here. The museum features scores of historic motorcycles from the company's history, and it tells the stories of the company's place in the American psyche.
It also tells a technical tale about why the engines that power Harleys look and sound the way they do. This spring, the so-called engine room in the Harley-Davidson Museum reopened after an overhaul. Much of the planning and design fell to two people at the museum, Bill Redensel, the collections lead, and Kristen Jones, curatorial and exhibits lead. And Jones started our tour of the space.
You know, the engine room is a really important part of our visit. It actually is in the beginning of the museum, so it really functions as an introduction to a lot of the things that people are going to see throughout the rest of the exhibits. We undertook some visitor research last year, and we were able to kind of do a deep dive into what our visitors thought of our exhibits and what they were learning in our exhibits. And one of the things that we found out was that they weren't exactly using the engine wall and the accompanying interactive in the way that we had hoped they would. So we wanted to address that, and we wanted to update some things, but also make this a little bit more user-friendly. We get all kinds of people who come here with all different levels of knowledge. We have people who come here who are completely green, don't really know anything about engines, know that, you know, with their cars, for instance, you turn the key and it goes. To people who have lots of expertise, people who are engineers, people who are long-term mechanics. So we wanted to do something that could really focus on all of those different levels of knowledge.
Well, and so from a curatorial standpoint, what was the challenge in being able to do that in this space?
One of the challenges that we faced was really trying to make sure that we were holding everyone's attention. We wanted to make sure we were giving some of the basics, but also not making people who had a certain level of expertise feel like, oh, well, this really isn't for me. I know all of this already. We want to make sure that we engage people. We want to give them something new, maybe something that they never expected or didn't know before.
All right. So what is that? What's the new and unexpected when it comes to showcasing engines?
Well, the engines are really the heart of a Harley-Davidson, and each one is purpose-built. It's purpose-designed. So some of the engines were really, you know, made for racing, for instance, or they were made to cool in the desert for use during World War II. But our big twin family, that's really the core of our engine and our engine history. And we wanted to be able to give people some information as to the very basics of how an engine works, but also give them some trivia and also give some other assets out here on the floor.
I'm kind of amazed as I look at this because you have them arranged on the wall in timeline fashion, and obviously the newer ones are more sophisticated, but the look really hasn't changed all that much in 100-plus years.
Correct. And that V-twin shape, that 45-degree V-twin engine is really the hallmark of our engine history. And that's what we wanted to portray by putting those engines in the center. So we relocated all of the big twins to the center of the wall so that they're prominent. We added some interpretation as well. But we do have some unusual-looking engines that really deviate from that as well.
Before we get into the actual mechanics of a Harley engine, what else is in this room?
So this room is our engine gallery. We have many things dedicated to the look of the engine, the sound of the engine, and also the feel of the engine. And those are kind of the hallmark traits of Harley-Davidson, look, sound, and feel. So in the center of the gallery, we have a bike that is a knucklehead, which actually is one of the nicknames of one of our famous V-twins, where the pieces have been sliced apart, but from a certain vantage point, it resolves into a full motorcycle.
And as someone who does this kind of thing for a living, that is kind of, I mean, the viewscape that you have in this room. I mean, it is a big room, and you have kind of this unique ability to arrange it in such a way that it can be broken down into its component parts, but you can stand in such a way that it resolves into a single bike.
Yes, it's the exploded vehicle. It does resolve from a certain vantage point. And again, because this is one of the first galleries that people encounter during their visit, we wanted to give kind of a nice little extra surprise for people.
All right, so I appreciate the look of the engine. I appreciate the sound of the engine. Never having ridden a Harley myself, tell me how you simulate the feel of an engine?
We have an interactive here in the engine gallery where we actually have people be able to get a little bit more of a sense of the feel of a motorcycle. Now, of course, we're on radio, so you don't see me, but I'm a smaller individual. But I am able to balance a motorcycle because of the gyroscopic effect that's created by the very heavy flywheels that are in the engine. So the bike, when it's running at that speed, really wants to stay upright. So that allows people of all different sizes to be able to get on a big bike and ride it.
All right. Well, I feel like at this point we really need to get more into the inner workings of the Harley engine. Take me through what visitors learn when they walk into this engine room. I'm sure they are drawn to this wall because A, it is illuminated, and B, it looks amazing.
Exactly. And that's part of the visual is to draw them in, to attract them here. And once we have them, what a lot of people, you know, they know an engine. They know it powers whatever vehicle it is. They just don't know actually how it works. So we tried to really simplify in the most basic terms, you know, how does an engine actually work? And people talk about, you know, our look, sound, feel. The way our engine and the geometry of our engine affects all of that. So we really explain through there. So we can actually, when guests come here, there are four kiosks that are all identical, have the same information, but they can step up to there, and there's three actual steps to the interactive. Engine basics, classic Harley engine, where you actually learn about our big twin, which is our classic Harley engine, and then get to explore all the engines that are exist on the engine wall. You get to actually look at both sides of them, see vehicles that they would be in, and then actually get to hear each and every engine that's on the wall.
And we should note that the engines on the wall are not the one that they don't actually start up.
They don't actually start up. What we did is we had about, in our previous iteration of the wall, we had about half of the sounds. So we went about kind of traveling the United States to find, because some of these engines, they may be they're one or two existing examples that actually run. And so we kind of did some field recordings to capture those unique sounds. And people get to hear a 1909 Harley single, or get to hear a Pose twin engine, which is a very different sounding engine than our typical twin.
So before we get to those sounds, because I think we really ought to hear some of those sounds, walk us through what we would learn here. What are the basics of a motorcycle engine?
So part of this wall, there's a little tactile display on the far right side and on the far left side, where, you know, people, you know a cylinder. Okay, well, what makes up a cylinder? What are the parts of that? So we actually have some pieces that they can touch and see to kind of get their feet wet a little bit before they get into the kiosk. Once they get into the kiosk, we start real simple. What's a one-cylinder and what's a two-cylinder, or our twin engine? When they started out, they called them singles and double cylinders, and now it's evolved into the twin. So you actually get to kind of look inside. So there's some animation. You get to see how does that piston go up, and what is a piston first, and how does it go up and down in the cylinder? How is it connected to the flywheel? And be able to compare and contrast between twins and single engines. And then you can actually touch the twins, and it'll highlight in a graphic which engines on the wall you're looking at are the twins or are the singles. We talk about the actual engine geometry, 45 degrees, where the cylinders are separated, 45 degrees, 60 degrees, or 180 degrees. This is a real big key in the sound of our engine. Engines have a cadence. And a single, having only one cylinder, is kind of a steady beat. In a 180-degree opposed twin, they fire actually opposite of each other. So it's boom, 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 boom. In our 45-degree twin, it's actually a cadence where they fire quickly after one another. So it's ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. Also in here, you get to look at how it works. When we do how it works, we put a simple drum beat to it. This is our 180 degree, and you can see it's pretty constant. When you go to our 45 degree twin, different pattern to that. And then, of course, single, when you go to the single, it's steady drumbeat.
Steady and in this case, very slow drumbeat.
Yeah, and you notice it's only hitting half the time as a twin cylinder. There's, you know, when we talk about the four actual patterns of an engine, the flywheel, the big flywheel in the engine, will actually rotate two complete times in order to complete those four cycles of a four-cycle engine.
And so, you went out on these field recordings?
I did, actually. Believe it or not, in a past life, my degree from college was in sound engineering, and so I used to do a lot of that. And so I worked with a local engineer, and we traveled as far away as North Carolina to actually capture some of these engines. Some of them we found right around here in Milwaukee. One of them, the rarest, being our 8-valve, which is our it's a race engine. They only made about 25 total. So finding one and then finding one that runs is really extremely rare.
That must have been a kick.
It was great. And we actually made a couple little films of it. And, you know, people will be able to actually, you know, go on our social media and see one of these run. They're really unique because there's no exhaust pipes on them. So the ports into the cylinder are open. And flames actually shoot out when it runs. So it's pretty neat.
We should hear this.
We should hear that one. Other race engines are XR750 that we had for years and years. And both of these are twin cylinders, but what's unique about them is even though they're all 45 degrees, there is some bit of similarity between all of those.
Is there one that we would maybe never recognize as a Harley-Davidson if it weren't for the fact that you were telling us?
Absolutely. So if you go to our singles, there's several in here, but one of them is, believe it or not, we made from 1961 until 1978, we were partnered with a company in Italy, and they made some Italian-made singles, so we'll take a listen to one of these. Harley-Davidson also made a single-cylinder engine that was a two-stroke engine. So when you think of two-stroke, think of your lawnmower or something similar to that. And it was 165cc engine, and we made that from the 40s into the mid-60s. And you can take a listen to one of those.
Maybe the slightest bit louder than a lawnmower.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But very different. Not what people think of as that quintessential Harley-Davidson potato, potato, potato.
Let me ask this question to both of you, actually.
Sure.
So this came together over how long did it take to bring this this revamped engine room together?
We were working on it for about 7 months.
So there has to be, if not a sense of ownership, certainly a real connection to what you've been able to do. As you look around, I mean, how do you, you know, sort of reconcile what was in your mind with what you see around us today?
I think what we've done really, you know, sometimes we were both involved in the original iteration, and sometimes it's hard to let go of that. But I think what we've done here really improves the experience for our visitors. You know, we are coming up on our 10th year of being open. And we're really evaluating how people have been using things here over the past 10 years and always looking to improve and always looking to give our visitors the best experience possible.
Well, right. I imagine that, you know, at one level you have to realize that that what you do doesn't exist in a vacuum. Like what you think visitors might get out of an exhibit and what they actually do get out of an exhibit can often be two different things.
Yes, I think that that's true. I think, you know, sometimes what people, what we envision people getting out of an exhibit is actually different from what we observe. And one of the things that's difficult, we have such an amazing, vast collection of materials here. And, of course, it's hard for us to sometimes decide what to edit. And that was one of the challenges with this engine wall is that we actually took some engines away because they didn't really help to tell the story that we were looking to tell.
I have to say, the thing that was really came through to me is we're such a small group that did this. And the first time we did it, it was we were we didn't know. We had never, even built a museum of this magnitude. So we were like, well, this would be neat. And even that changed as we did it. And you came out with the final product, and it was great. Then you find out, we could have done it better. And so we're really lucky to get that second shot to say, let's do it. Let's do some of the things we wanted to do in the first time. Like Kristen said, take away some of the things that, we put up there just because they were neat, but did they confuse people? Did it not really, tell that story that you wanted to communicate? Plus, in 10 years, the company has changed a lot, and we've come out with a lot of different new products, and we want to represent those on the wall as well.
Has to be a little like being a musician who, puts out an album and figures, well, this one's going to be the hit, and it turns out everybody likes this one.
A little bit of that, or the musician that says, oh, if I could go in and re-record that. And so we were given the ability to actually, do a do-over and say, let's do it. And so we didn't really radically change it, because it's quite behind the actual wall, the structure that holds it up. There's no moving it. It's pretty permanent. But we were able to, shift it around and really, I think, just tell the story clearer.
Got to be a pretty strong wall. Those must be pretty heavy engines.
There's quite a superstructure, actually, behind the drywall there. But we've actually modified the way that we're attaching the engines so that in the future, as we want to make additional changes, we can do so more easily.
Well, thanks to both of you, and congratulations on the redesign.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
No stop signs, speed limit. Nobody's gonna slow me down. Like a wheel, gonna spin it. Nobody's gonna mess me around.
Kristen Jones is the curatorial and exhibits lead, and Bill Rodenzel is the collections lead at the Harley-Davidson Museum. You can see pictures from the engine room and find links to more about this weekend's festivities at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.